rudimentary version of Taekwondo. I was fit at the time, but this was way beyond me. In a deserted mock-up town, they were given practice at firing weapons, assault rifles, pistols, belt-fed general-purpose machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, explosive ordnance, booby traps, demolition, all forms of explosives, command detonation, radio detonation. They learnt the best way to kill a man, stab a man in the back of the neck, and then twist, cutting into the cerebral cortex. Next came kidnapping techniques, but it was the explosives training that interested the sticks the most. They worked with ammonium nitrate explosive, which looked like a bar of soap with a pre-drilled hole in it, in which Len, the engineer in the group of six, would place his detonator. They gave us a mathematical formula for knowing how much explosive you'd need to blow the doors off a Securicore van, but it was too bloody complicated. Gauging how much explosive to use on a job was a real problem for the official IRA when they went fundraising, a West Belfast North Korean echo of the moment in the film The Italian Job, when the bullion gang blow a van to smithereens and Michael Caine complains, "You were only supposed to blow the bloody doors off." The Irishman talked about a gift for Kim Il-sung, which had been delivered to him, but they never got to meet him in person. The gift was a beautiful piece of Bilic porcelain woven in ceramics to look like basketwork and more than a century old. "Where did you get that from?" I asked foolishly. "It wasn't bought in a shop," said Len. Whether the great leader ever realized that he was on the receiving end of stolen goods is another matter. The Koreans thought that back home the Sticks had a full-scale army, with tanks in the mountains waiting for the revolution. "Garland was conning them," said Len. The Sticks kept mum about how small their numbers were, perhaps 50 fighters if that, and carried on with the training. Eventually the North Koreans sent them around 50 Tokarev handguns, the Pyongyang edition of an old Soviet pistol. They had two minders, Mr. Ho and Mr. Hong, whom they jointly nicknamed Hong Kong. They got on with them well enough, but made time go faster by taking the mick. They realized that food and drink came best in quality and quantity when there was a banquet, so the Sticks told the Koreans that Halloween was a holy feast day for the Irish. They boosted the holy feast of Halloween as much as they could, drank themselves silly, but Len was still conscious enough to notice that Mr. Ho and Mr. Hong wrapped up the leftovers from the banquet in napkins and spirited them away in their pockets. Their living conditions were Spartan, but they knew they were well off in comparison with the North Koreans. One group of soldiers lived in a hole in the ground with a wooden roof, keeping the snow, which started to fall in late November, off their heads. The Irishmen were not the only foreigners at the base. There were some Palestinians, too, whom the Maltesers were kept well away from, and a group of Africans from the Tanzanian Air Force. Other sources say that the North Koreans have traded weapons with and or trained a licorice all sorts of terrorist organizations over the years, including Hezbollah, the Tamil Tigers, and even Osama bin Laden's money man, Dr. Amin, and others in the Taliban. The goal appears to have been to make trouble for the West. "We became bored extremely quickly," said Len. "Up at 6:30 a.m., running around the parade ground in pitch darkness before breakfast, we knew it was a load of bollocks." Pretty soon the Sticks started to mutiny. Getting up and running around in the dark, we thought, "Fuck this," and told Ho and Hong we weren't doing it. To keep morale up, they were taken to the circus. It was amazing, but the whole audience was in uniform. Most comical of all was they were taken on a merry-go-round. "They filmed us. If that film ever comes out, it would be a disaster. The sight of the men from the IRA riding up and down on hobby horses. We all looked like such a bunch of fucking cunts." There were precious few women around. They lived a monastic existence. But Len recalled one of the maids in the barracks. When we were served food, she always served me first. When we had apples, she would peel it for me, the whole thing coming off. So thinly peeled, it was a work of art. A punch-up brought an end to their stay. Two sticks got stuck into each other, hammering away. When one of the fighters was beaten, he slunk off, lay in wait in the dark, and got hammered again, almost killing him. The North Korean base commander called them in, dressed them down. The sticks replied that their training program wasn't working for them. After 2 months, Len and two others were on their way home. As he was leaving, Len gave the apple peel lady a chocolate bar, for which she thanked him with a gracious smile. The three others stayed an extra month and then packed their bags as well. It was wonderful getting home to Belfast after all that time. The cold, the hunger, the boredom, the power cuts, the lighting of candles in the evening, the lack of free thought. In the end, Len hated it. Looking back on North Korea now, Len believes, "It was the worst place I ever went to. The poor bastards believe they are living in utopia." I met Liam, another surprisingly well-travelled Irishman, this time from the south, in a bar in Dublin. Back in the 1970s, he got involved in a strike, and the experience scarred him. He became a committed man of the left, a Marxist, and a member of the Irish Workers' Party, a stick, but not an IRA man. When Liam was asked to go on a trip to East Germany, the Soviet Union, and North Korea in the autumn of 1989, 1 year after Len, he leapt at the chance. It turned out to be the greatest adventure and the most eye-opening experience of his life, but it ended up killing his faith. In September 1989, Secretary General Garland and Liam flew to Moscow to attend an immense Soviet book fair. 3 months before the fall of the Berlin Wall, Liam had no sense that anything very much was in the air. Soviet power seemed solid enough. But the trip didn't fuel his commitment to socialism. Far from it. "They put us up in the Hotel Rossiya, a huge fucking dump by the Kremlin. Garland pulled some strings and we moved to a party hotel, the Oktoberskaya. There the food was excellent and we didn't have to share rooms." Already Liam was beginning to sense that socialism, Soviet style, was less about equality for all and more about who you knew. But the person who really knocked his faith was a beautiful young Russian woman, Elena. She had amber hair, green eyes, skin like the inside of an eggshell. At first, Elena just came to the Irish Workers' Party stand at the book fair to practice her English, but soon Liam had to be inventive so that he could spend more and more time with her, and less with Garland. Elena, once she realized that Liam was a true believer, was cruelly dismissive. She took me to Goom, the biggest store in the whole of Moscow, and threw open her arms and said, "There is nothing that we want here. You can't want this. You have no idea what it's like. We cannot breathe. You're going home to spread the gospel of bread queues." Their love affair was never consummated, but even now, more than 20 years later, the light in Liam's eyes grew fierce when he talked about her. Garland and Liam flew first class to North Korea with a stopover in Siberia. That experience, too, dented his passion. "We got out of the plane and had a spell in the Siberian airport. A fucking pig would have thought twice about going to the toilet. Blood lay in a pool on the floor of the duty-free shop." Their welcome in Pyongyang was astonishing. No one else was allowed off the plane until Garland and I walked down the steps. We were driven away in a great big black Mercedes-Benz. I had never been in one before. There was maybe 30 police motorbike outriders racing down these enormous empty roads. Liam was awestruck by Pyongyang at first. It looked magnificent. The physical structures were impressive. The city had been dolled up to the nines in 1988 to look its best as Seoul hosted the Olympics. 1 year on, Pyongyang still looked smart. Garland and Liam were given luxury villas in a compound not far from the heart of the capital. It was the absolute subservience of the staff that chilled Liam. If they saw you, they would freeze on the spot, eyes down, and stay frozen until you passed. They were virtually slaves. It was so servile, the bowing and scraping. I remember I said to myself, "Do we really want this for Ireland?" Liam continued, "Sean did the political meetings, and I was not invited to them. I had a driver who spoke some English, and he drove me around. We saw the sights. One morning, I spotted the workers in their black clobber going off to build the Christmas tree at the Ryugyong Hotel, which does have a rough triangular symmetry, singing their hearts out. They worked like ants. Jesus, imagine waking up to that every day of your life. North Korea was the strangest place I've ever been to. Back then, Pyongyang was a beautiful city, but the people, it was like a science fiction movie. The people were the aliens. Jesus Christ, you can't but feel sorry for them." They flew home via East Berlin. Liam took a deep breath. "If Elena and the poor people of North Korea didn't do it for me, the fucking wall did. The closer I got to it, the more horrified I became. I said, Jesus, no, 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 for fuck's sake. Any fucking system that needs a wall needs tearing down." Once they got back to Ireland, Garland asked him a subtle question. Would Liam know of anyone who would be willing to take a small package from Dublin to Copenhagen? He was really asking me to do it, of course. Denmark was then the only place with a North Korean embassy, so I kind of guessed it was something to do with them. I said no. Liam was wise not to play courier for Sean Garland. It hadn't been Garland's first trip to North Korea, but his sixth. The Korean Central News Agency, the mouthpiece of the North Koreans, reported Garland's first trip in 1983. Garland had told his hosts, according to BBC monitoring at Caversham, "The Korean people, under the wise guidance of the great leader President Kim Il-sung, are registering wonderful successes in the struggle to reunify the divided country. I firmly believe that the US and other imperialists would surely be annihilated on the globe by the struggle of the Irish people and the Korean people." Why did Garland go to North Korea six times? It might have seemed that Garland was taken in on that first trip to North Korea in 1983. Workers' Life, the Workers' Party magazine, reported on his visit to the much-vaunted West Sea Barrage. "The standard of living is quite high, and the ships are well-stocked. The people are well-dressed, and there were no indications of the sort of poverty that we witness in this country." What Garland and his fellow sticks actually thought was something different. Colm Brannock in the Workers' Party youth wing went with Garland on his first trip to Pyongyang. Years later, Brannock reflected on the trip to NK News. "In many ways, they, the Workers' Party, were more old-fashioned Republicans who kind of grafted on pro-Soviet politics onto some kind of left-wing Republicanism. And they weren't fools. Of course they knew it was a load of shit." So why did Garland keep going back? Was it the ideological twinning between the two movements, both of which were intent on uniting their divided countries? The great man himself is quoted in The Lost Revolution, talking about the 1983 trip, which had arisen after conversations with the North Korean embassy in Denmark. Garland said, "We had heard all these stories about North Korea, but we met them anyway. It was a small country, divided, isolated, blockaded economically, politically, militarily, and they were trying to do what they could themselves. We pointed out to them, for instance, putting full-page ads in the Irish Times of Kim Il-sung's thoughts, was a waste of money because nobody fucking read them. They were paying £5,000. If the North Koreans were so daft they would throw away £5,000 a pop by droning on about Kim Il-sungism in Ireland's most conservative newspaper, would they fund the Workers' Party and Chums? That was the view of Brannock, that the driver in the 1980s was funding for elections. To that end, perhaps, dissent about North Korea was suppressed. When journalist Paddy Woodworth wrote a critical article in 1983 for the party's magazine, Rubbing the Kim Dynasty, it was not published. Garland reportedly told the author, "Ah, come on, Paddy, I'm looking for support from these people." In 1984, Garland and the president of the Workers' Party, Tomas Magilla, met Kim Il-sung and Hwang Chong-yop, who subsequently defected to South Korea in 1997. The great leader told the Irishman, "Both the Korean people and the Irish people have a bitter past when they were oppressed and maltreated under the colonial rule of the imperialists. The relationship between our two parties was established on the occasion of Comrade General Secretary Sean Garland's visit to our country in September last year. Your party is vigorously struggling to get the British occupation forces out of the Northern Ireland." The Irishman gave Kim Il-sung a present. The news agency did not report exactly what kind of present, but added, po-faced, that the delegation explained the gift to Comrade Kim Il-sung. This may have been the bleak porcelain, in which case it was stolen goods. In 1986, there was no BBC monitoring report of a Workers' Party trip, but reportedly one took place. One of the delegates with Garland was Pronces Di Rosa, who later became a government minister and Euro MP. As the wheels came off the Workers' Party bus later on, Di Rosa openly criticised the Pyongyang connection. North Korea was, he said, a completely unreal society where people were basically treated as children, not as adults at all. In 1987, Garland was reported by the BBC, who had been monitoring the KCNA, to be back in Pyongyang, and again in the following year, 1988, for the regime's 40th birthday celebrations, along with other European communists, including one David Richards of the Communist Party of Great Britain. It was time to return North Korea's hospitality. Kim Yong-soon, a director of the International Affairs Department, arrived in Dublin for a fraternal visit. That October, Len and the boys from West Belfast arrived in Pyongyang. Garland returned to North Korea twice in 1989, according to the KCNA, in May when he met Kim Yong-soon for a second time, and then with Liam in September. On this second 1989 trip, Garland was also reported to have met Kim Yong-soon again. Remember that name. Sinn Féin, the political movement which marched in step with the provisional IRA, dallied with North Korea too. The main Sinn Féin enthusiast for Pyongyang was Jerry McLaughlin, who served 2.5 years from 1981 for conspiracy to cause explosions. Once out of prison, he knocked out a pamphlet entitled The Irish Republican and Juche's Conception of National Self-Dignity Are One. The pamphlet concluded, according to Martin Frampton, a British academic and the only man I know who's bothered to read it, that the Juche's concept of Chaju Song, the notion that national pride is the foundation upon which revolutionary struggle must be based, expresses so clearly the aspirations and the needs of colonial and semi-colonial peoples that its message was relevant not just to Ireland but to all freedom-struggling peoples throughout the world. In 1986, Sinn Féin sent a message of solidarity to the North Korean regime. "We offer our support to the Workers' Party of Korea in its fight for the establishment of the Democratic Confederated Republic of Korea." In 1987, Sinn Féin's president, Gerry Adams, attended a reception at the North's embassy in Denmark to toast the 75th birthday of Kim Il-sung. In 1989, Sinn Féin delegates McLaughlin, Sheena Campbell, later shot dead in 1992 by loyalists, and John Doyle attended the World Youth Festival in Pyongyang. Whether the IRA proper was trained by North Korea is unknown. The evidence in the public domain suggests that Sinn Féin did not develop the same kind of traction with Pyongyang that Sean Garland and the Workers' Party did. One man ultimately doing Garland's bidding was Hugh Todd, a South African citizen of Irish stock. In a hotel room in Birmingham, Todd boasted to one of his mates how he smuggled fake dollars through international frontiers. Little did he know that the conversation wasn't entirely private. Oblivious to the tape silently spooling his every word, Todd told an undercover officer. "But he wants to change the moody, crooked dollars into different currencies. Now I have to change those back into fucking dollars. I was going to meet him in Frankfurt. I was going from South Africa to Frankfurt and Frankfurt to Moscow. I've got 180,000 fucking dollars. There's a big parcel like that. Now I've got to go back through those fucking customs, and I'm watching as you go, you know. They're putting the bag through the scanner, and there's a fella the far side, and the odd one he stops and searches. I had the fucking thing stuffed down there, stuffed down everywhere. I can feel one slipping down the fucking inside of my fucking pants. Put my bag through, walked straight through, not searched, end of fucking story. I'm gone. I go into the fucking Irish bar, I go out, I go into the toilet, take my bag like that, take all my dollars out, grand. Put them all into the bag, sweet, I'm through." The tape was brought to a wider audience by BBC Panorama reporter Declan Lawn and executive producer Jeremy Adams in 2004. But what Todd was explaining is the often tricky process of washing counterfeit money. The source would provide the fake dollar notes, which would then be passed off as real currency in banks and through purchases around the world. Once converted back into proper dollars, after a large cut had been taken, the bank notes would be returned to the source so it could bank, as it were, the profit. And that meant, in Todd's case, returning the cash to somewhere in Moscow. Was that the original source of the super dollars? The bugged conversations between the money laundering gang are priceless. Here's another super dollar mule, Brummy Alan Jones, bugged in a car, boasting about how the super dollars were the best fakes in the world. "The people who handled them all the time would take them for real ones. Had every test done on them you can think of." Jones seemed clear there was nothing morally wrong in what he was doing. "There's nothing to do now except earn a few quid for them, is there? There's nobody to kill, that's it. The FBI and that firm know about 'em, but they're called the super dollar. There's that many of them in their economy, it's a fucking joke. It's been going on for 12 years. Everybody is sticking them into them. They take no notice of 'em now." Jones was not entirely correct about that. True, the FBI wasn't listening in, but the United States Secret Service, it guards the president and the currency, was, along with some of Britain's best detectives. Terry Silcock was another small-time crook who got in way over his head. He seemed particularly scared of another money-laundering conspirator, David Levin, a Russian, as he told two prospective buyers who were unfortunately undercover cops. "He, Levin, turned up with these fucking 5 Russians. They all got black leather jackets and dark skin, and they've got a guy in the back of the car that they've bagged and they won't let go. And they come to meet me like that." But who was running the operation? Silcock told the undercover officers what he knew. "I will level with you saying that you have a perfect 100% understanding. Then you can't come back to me. They're printed by the IRA and the KGB. Silcock was wrong about that. The Americans suspected that at the end of the trail, beginning with the crooks from Birmingham, was Room 39, the secret organization within the Kim's secret state, running the North Korean palace economy, and up to its neck in gun running, high crimes, and counterfeiting. It is also called Bureau 39, Division 39, and Office 39, but the pure Orwellianism of Room 39 is the most satisfactory translation. The very first super dollar was spotted by a bank teller in the Philippines in 1989, the very same year that Garland went to North Korea, twice. The super dollar note was a forgery of the $100 US bill of such exquisite accuracy, the joke was it was more perfectly made than the US originals. The ink, the paper's manufacture, even the printing presses were virtually exactly the same as those used by the United States Bureau of Engraving and Printing. But working out who was counterfeiting these superfakes was never going to be easy. The mock dollars popped up in all sorts of places. When they emerged in the Lebanon, suspicion centered on Iran. But if it was the Iranians, why would super dollars pop up in Macau or Peru or Dublin or the British city with more miles of canal than Venice? Birmingham. The source of the super dollars finally came to something approaching daylight in 2005, when Sean Garland was arrested as he was about to address a meeting of Irish nationalists in Belfast. The United States Secret Service unsealed an indictment seeking the extradition, it read, of Sean Garland, also known as the Man with the Hat. The legal papers, one reporter observed, read like a bad airport spy novel. Also wanted by the Americans was Garland's fellow Irishman Christopher Corcoran, a Russian national David Levin, also known as David Batikovich Batikian, or Gediminas Gutautas, or Russian Dave, or Doctor, of Birmingham, Todd, then 68, an Irish and South African citizen living in South Africa, and also known by the names F.B. Rawling and Peter Keith Clark, and three Britons, Mark Adderley, Silcock, and Jones, whose comments on tape we've already heard. The men were accused for their part in washing super dollars, taking in locations as glamorous as the Hotel Metropole in Moscow and as unglamorous as the Holyhead Ferry. One boasts the scent of perfume, the other of vomit. The U.S. Attorney's Office, making the case for the Secret Service, claimed Garland had been running the superdollar racket for years. The indictment named Garland as the leader of the official IRA, a claim he strongly denies, and stated that North Korean officials introduced counterfeit $100 bills to Ireland in the early 1990s, and Garland obtained more of them in Minsk, Belarus. The indictment claimed the notes began to appear in worldwide circulation in 1989 and were manufactured under the auspices of the North Korean government. The Americans alleged that the notes began appearing in Ireland during the early 1990s, but were eventually refused by Irish banks. Garland, the man with the hat, attracted the Americans' attention at around the same time, when the first super notes appeared on Dublin streets. But they had no hard evidence to nail him. Law enforcement got a break when Todd, who had a previous conviction for passing off counterfeit money, was spotted exchanging the notes in British banks. He was caught red-handed with a bundle of fake notes when he was arrested in 1994. Todd led to two Birmingham criminals, Silcock and Jones. But the Americans weren't that interested in the small fry. They wanted Mr. Big, and the chain beyond him that led to North Korea. The Americans waited a whole decade until they were happy they had the evidence they needed. In 1996, the U.S. redesigned its banknotes for the first time since 1928 to add additional security features, including, on the $100 bill, a winsome smile to Benjamin Franklin's face and a bigger head, the Big Head. The U.S. went to great lengths to keep one step ahead of the counterfeiters, using tiny lettering, a watermark shadow of the portrait on the bill, and a security thread weaved in the paper. The real toughie to copy was their use of special optically variable ink, or OVI. Turn the bill one way and it looks bronze green, explained the New York Times. Turn it the other way and it looks black. OVI is very expensive, costing many times more than conventional banknote ink. 1 year later, Garland traveled to Moscow. There, Garland went to the North Korean embassy to arrange, it was alleged, the shipment of new big-head fake $100 bills, which the North Koreans had somehow speedily copied. Not long after Garland returned to Dublin, super big-head notes popped up in Ireland. Corcoran, Silcock and Adderley were said to have solicited David Levin, a former KGB agent turned British criminal, as a potential buyer for the notes. In the first 6 months of 1998, Garland was alleged to have travelled to Moscow 3 times to pick up new batches of super notes from the North Korean embassy. The Americans put pressure on the Russians to tell the North Koreans to stop mucking about, so Pyongyang switched operations to Minsk, the capital of nearby Belarus, and safely under the control of Europe's last dictator, if you say Europe stops at the Russian border, President Lukashenko. Team Sticky started beating a trail to Minsk instead. Levin allegedly used his Russian contacts to arrange fake passports and fake Belarus visas to help them. But the cracks were starting to show. The gang were becoming suspicious that they had a mole, and everyone became more paranoid. Levin explained that he was having serious problems offloading the super notes in Russia and Germany. Garland, wary that he might be being cheated, demanded evidence of Levin's problems, and this was gold for the British crime squad and the Americans listening in the dark. Levin got his mule Silcock to fax Garland a document in Russian showing that Russian banks had detected the supernotes, and a second document in German proving that the Germans had confiscated $250,000. Both faxes were read by the British crime squad. By June 1999, Levin came up with $98,000 to give to Garland and passed it on to a courier to deliver to Dublin. The crime squad arrested Levin the following day. He told them that he didn't know the money he received was counterfeit. A month later, he allegedly gave limited cooperation to police, telling them the whereabouts in Moscow of $70,000 in super notes. These notes were then picked up by the Russian authorities as evidence. The same day, Silcock was arrested at a Birmingham boozer, the White Swan, also known more suitably as the Mucky Duck. Jones was picked up a few days later. In 2002, Levin, Silcock and Adderley were jailed for 9, 6 and 4 years, respectively, for what police said was the largest counterfeit dollar operation ever seen in Britain. Silcock alone handled $4.2 million in counterfeit money, the court heard, and the whole operation was worth $29 million. What the North Koreans made of these events, we'll never know. After the super dollar convictions in 2002, the Americans waited another 3 years before they pounced on Garland. He made the mistake of leaving the Irish Republic and going to Northern Ireland for a Workers' Party conference. Once arrested, he pleaded ill health, was released from British custody, and slipped back over the border to the Irish Republic, not for the first time. Ireland, some say, doesn't like extraditing old IRA men anywhere, and Garland was no exception. Irish TDs, that is, members of Parliament, and artists such as Pete Seeger, Christy Moore, Alabama 3, and John Spillane campaigned against an old and sick man being sent to America to stand trial. Just before Christmas in 2011, an Irish judge decided that Garland was staying in Ireland. In the United States, the other men indicted have never been brought to court. There is no doubting the extraordinary technical achievement of the North Korean counterfeiting operation. The world's most vocally anti-capitalist state made a killing out of Uncle Sam. Two North Korean defectors told Panorama what the North had got up to. One said, "When I defected, I brought some of these counterfeit notes to South Korea, and I showed them to the experts in the South Korean intelligence agency. They said, 'These are not fake notes. They are real. These are the people who are supposed to be professionals.' I thought to myself, 'You have no idea. I'm the professional here. This is what I used to do.' The counterfeiting was all done at government level. We had a special plant for doing it in." A second defector said, "We bought the best of everything, the best equipment and the best ink, but we also had the very best people, people who had real expertise and knowledge in the field. Then, when government officials or diplomats travelled to Southeast Asia, they distributed the counterfeit notes mixed in with the real ones at a ratio of about 50-50. Two more defectors told the Daily NK website in 2005, after the U.S. indictment against Garland had emerged, of the location of the secret counterfeiting plant. The third defector, who smuggled himself out of the North in 2000, said he had lived in Pyongsung, north of Pyongyang, where many locals knew that they printed fake dollars at the Trademark Printery in Samha town. "It is an open secret to the residents of Pyongsung. I directly heard about it from the workers of the Party Center and of the National Security Agency." He described the Trademark Printery as a small concrete building, not entirely anonymous, with signboard surrounded by barbed wire and patrolled by soldiers. The fourth defector explained that his sources, state-licensed traders who worked for the regime, were permitted to smuggle old, used Japanese cars into North Korea and then sell them on in China. The direct used car trade route from Japan to China is barred by Chinese import controls. The defector explained, "The Chinese smugglers who bought the used cars also wanted to buy forged U.S. dollar bills from us. Forged bills are sold for half of their face value. Trade workers of the Central Party mix forged U.S. dollar bills with genuine bills when they circulate them in volume. They take the forgeries from Pyongsung." The State Department's point man cracking down on the counterfeiting was David L. Asher. In a speech, Asher accused North Korea of counterfeiting, manufacturing drugs, money laundering, arms sales, and illicit trade in sanctioned items such as conflict diamonds, rhino horn, and ivory. "Under international law, counterfeiting another nation's currency is an act of casus belli, an act of economic war. No other government has engaged in this act against another government since the Nazis under Hitler. North Korea is the only government in the world today that can be identified as being actively involved in directing crime as a central part of its national economic strategy and foreign policy." And that made it, he said, the soprano state. My Irish friend Liam, after his adventures in the Soviet Union, North Korea, and East Germany, stayed connected to the Workers' Party for another 10 years, but his passion for the cause was slowly dying. It was a case, he thought, of not knowing what to do next. After he left, other members questioned him at funerals. "Why weren't you at the party meeting?" Soon he was shunned, he said, like the Amish. And what of Kim Jong-soon? The North Korean who met Garland twice in 1989 came to a sticky end in 2003, not that long after the British trial when the superdollar mules were convicted. Kim died in yet another North Korean car accident, most likely executed by the state for failure. The North Koreans had their official say in 2005, shortly after Garland was arrested. The BBC reported that the North's KCNA news agency in Pyongyang had struck back, declaring, "The United States has recently escalated its smear campaign against the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Typical of this is its fiction about a deal in counterfeits floated by the U.S. this time. The U.S. is claiming that the DPRK is massively issuing highly sophisticated false 100 U.S. dollar notes known as super money and spreading them worldwide. In order to verify this, no sooner had Sean Garland, leader of the Irish Workers' Party, been arrested than the U.S. Department of Justice released on the 7th of October a written indictment which it has long prepared. The written indictment, characterized by extreme nature of politicization and selection, said that there was a deal in counterfeits between the DPRK and Garland. Nothing is clumsier than what was invented by the U.S., a past master at lies, fabrication, disinformation, and plot. The accused, North Korea, doth protest too much. I say that with confidence because, apart from the American indictment against Garland, the British court convictions, and all the other evidence cited above, Len the Stick told me that he had counted some of the cash in Belfast after it had been converted from the moody North Korean bills into pounds sterling. "I would count £30,000 just in one day. And remember, we had only one team, and there were five teams working. Men were sent around Europe. I had a contact in the United States, and he moved $700,000 in the fake bills. What was his cut?" I asked. "Remember, I was fighting for a cause, so I got paid around £40 a day to count £300,000. Today, Len realizes that the Sticks were little more than Sean Garland's private army. "I woke up in around 1996. But, like all the Sticks, he remains grateful that his version of the IRA didn't go in for 25 years of mass murder. I had to ask one last thing. I'd heard a story that one Stick got to go to the DMZ and managed to look at a U.S. Marine through the sights of a sniper rifle. Did you do that?" "No," said Len. "It was Fat Frankie who did that on Christmas Eve." I shook Len's hand, and he walked out of the bar, one of the Irishmen kicked out of North Korea because of bad behavior. Chapter 16. Empty Bellies. Day 6, and our coach left Pyongyang for the east coast resort of Wonsan. We were crossing the spine of the country, going up and up through terrifying tunnels, entirely unlit with dripping wet walls where the danger came from oncoming lorries with poor to no lights, and then out again into the fresh air, birds of prey spinning in thermals far below us. At lunch we stopped for a picnic at what promised to be a magnificent waterfall. We could hear the Ulim waterfall, but we couldn't see it. Stiff after 3 hours in the coach, we all wanted to walk towards the falls, but for some reason our guides held us back. And then it came to me in a brainwave. "They're switching on the waterfall!" A joke that had Miss June bent double with laughter. Even Mr. Hyun may have raised a wintry bank manager's smile, but I might have been mistaken. Bizarrely, there were two roads to the waterfall, a wholly unnecessary waste of tarmac. The road on the right of the river flowing down from the falls was beautifully asphalted and rested on concrete stilts, elegantly constructed. The road on the left was far simpler. I started walking up the posh road, nothing is too good for ordinary people, and was quickly ordered by one of the guides to get back on the simple road. Only when the waterfall hove into view did the reason for the two roads become obvious. The road to the right ended at a Bond villain-style chalet with a prime view of the falls. We were asked not to take photos of the chalet, but everyone did anyway. The special road and the chalet had clearly been created for the leaders, great, dear, and fat. From this, you could get some sense of the colossal waste of resources the demands of the palace economy create for the whole country. It is hard to imagine anything more economically unproductive than a duplicate road, one for the scum, one for their majesties. The walk uphill made me fancy a swim. This might have been an eccentric decision. Mr. Hyun, Miss June, and the Continentalists looked on aghast as the only British student, Fred, and I stripped down to our underpants and waded in. On the bank, a great block of unfrozen ice lay, a warning unheeded. It was testicle-shrivelingly cold, and I wanted to go back the moment I had stuck my toe in, but thankfully Fred gave me a playful shove, and I collapsed into the ice water. Once in, it seemed only proper to swim towards the falls a bit. On the way out, I stood up and posed for the cameras, arms akimbo, in prize-fighter mode. But this was fakery. On leaving the water, I was shivering so much I could barely stand up, and Mr. Hyun, wearing a full-length black overcoat and frankly creepy black gloves against the cold, steadied me while I put my socks and trousers back on. Only at the end of the tour did Mr. Hyun point out that other tour groups had gone for a dip, but later in the year, in the summer. This was the earliest and coldest swim ever. As Fred and I basked in the warm glow of his praise, Mr. Hyun unsheathed his dagger. "Next time you go swimming, Professor, no holes in your underpants." I blushed then, I blush now. Our picnic in the cold sun was a pleasant break from the torture of long drawn-out meals in the fanciest restaurants in North Korea. While we were messing about, a North Korean child came out from nowhere and started fishing for frogs. He used a long stick with a dead frog speared on the end of it. The moment a live frog would grip the dead frog, he upended the stick and dropped the frog into a bucket. It was only when we got close up that we realized he wasn't a child at all, but a tiny adult with a wizened face, maybe 50 years old. Outside of Pyongyang, people we saw were generally shorter. This man from the mountain country looked like a pygmy, evidence of famine written in bone. The hotel-restaurant affair where our coach was parked had not yet opened for what passes as the tourist season, so we had to pee behind it. There we saw our first dog in our whole time in North Korea, a miniature Alsatian-y thing, cute, fluffy but filthy, covered in dusty mud. No one dared touch him. The absence of things dulls the mind quite quickly, but it is worth reporting that even here, far away from the city, there were no ducks, chickens, or birds to be seen, no wildlife of any kind, apart from the stray dog and frogs being remorselessly hunted by the child man. Next stop was the Wonsan Agriculture University. As ever, our tour started with an introduction by the local guide dressed in traditional garb. As ever, she said that the university had been founded thanks to the wisdom and inspiration of the great leader Kim Il-sung and the dear leader Kim Jong-il. We were taken to the main entrance of the university, a grey monstrosity boasting a large portrait of Kim Il-sung with gleaming Doris Day teeth. Inside, there was yet another exhibition of the great and happy moments when Kim's major and minor had visited the university. There were no students in sight. Jice and Fred were dawdling at the back and somehow took a wrong turning and ended up in a courtyard. There they found a drum set. Jice, who fancies himself as a Moroccan Charlie Watts, takes up the story. I decided to jam on the drum set for about 5 minutes, only to find out at the end of my jam that 40 North Korean students had emerged from nowhere and were staring in awe at the performance. When I finished, they were all clapping. Mr. Hyun appeared, infuriated since I had strayed off with Fred for my little performance. It was one of the most surreal experiences ever. I was like an alien to the North Korean students. It was probably the weirdest thing they'd seen, a foreigner from Morocco who couldn't communicate with them, who just started playing on their drum set while another filmed with his iPhone, and then just left, dragged away by his angry minder. The tour, like the struggle, continued. We came upon a fair-sized greenhouse, complete with ripening tomatoes and orchid-like flowers. I zoned out. But I may well have been shown Kim Il-sungia or Kim Jong-ilia, two flowers specially made to honour the great men. Kim Il-sungia is a purple orchid. Kim Jong-ilia, as the hitch, ever the one to spot small gradations of class differentiation, even in horticulture, points out, a low-rent begonia. Everard, the former British ambassador, is especially funny about the fuss the regime made when it came to floral respects to the leaders, great and dear. He writes, "Ambassadors were routinely invited to see the display of flowers by different units from around the country. This unusual form of political flower arrangement was fiercely competitive. An official from a central government ministry once invited me to come and look at the ministry's display, and it was indeed impressive. Then she took me to see the display of another government department, a much less elaborate offering. 'I think they tried quite hard,' she said, oozing schadenfreude." Everard goes on, "I worked out that in 1 year we had spent longer debating the EU presence at the flower show than discussing human rights in North Korea." The former ambassador adds a footnote, mildly enfeebling his point. Whether the footnote was his own idea or something suggested by a desk waller at King Charles Street before copy approval for his book was given is not entirely clear. To be fair to the European florist diplomats, the regime addresses any attempt to discuss human rights of its own people with a wall of marble, as Senator Macaluso observed way back in 1969. But, for example, in the late 1980s, at least some of Europe's diplomats did stick it to Ceausescu's tyranny. Arranging flowers nicely should not, perhaps, be a primary occupation of European diplomacy in Pyongyang. Our tour continued along a concrete path on which were marked two green crosses, indicating where the hallowed feet of Kim Il-sung had stopped, the better to give on-the-spot guidance, yet more evidence that visiting North Korea is like being inside an enormous cult. To rub the point home was a large painting of Kim I, sporting a white hat in grey business suit and tie, shielding his eyes from the sun, with Kim II standing a few yards back, in blue Mao suit and holding a stalk of wheat in his hands. Behind him, a Korean farmer and his wife stand, smiling appreciatively, in a field bursting with wheat. He's holding a book, presumably Juche's line on planting wheat. The sun is shining, but there are some sweet fluffy clouds in the sky. The reality, of course, is entirely different. That the first two Kims wrecked North Korean agriculture and the people starved because of their folly. The painting is a monstrous deceit. The true cause of the famine which gripped the land from 1996 to 1999 is a non-subject in North Korea. It happened, according to famine expert Jasper Becker, because of a long-term collapse in agriculture under Kim I, which no one could articulate. The leadership never grasped the extent of the unfolding disaster because no one dared tell Kim Il-sung the truth. The great economist Amartya Sen, whose native Bengal suffered too often from famine during centuries of British imperial rule, noted, A free press and an active political opposition constitute the best early warning system a country threatened by famine can have. In North Korea, journalism, the job of telling the stories power and money do not want told, of giving a voice to the voiceless, does not exist. Kim Il-sung died before the famine turned critical in 1994 to mass mourning, apart, that is, from the embalmers in Moscow who reportedly charged the DPRK $1 million for turning him into a waxwork. But the failure of North Korean agriculture over time, created by the state's diktat forbidding a free market, is the responsibility of Kim Il-sung. His son is to blame for following slavishly in his father's footsteps. How many people died? Foreign experts dispute the numbers. There feels something wrong, obscene even, about arguing about how many people died in a famine. Once the numbers go beyond a few thousand, that's too many. But the lowest credible estimate, according to one of the best, most humane and dryly cynical Pyongyangologists in the world, Andrei Lankov, is around 500,000, or 2.5% of the population. This is roughly equal to the ratio of Chinese farmers who perished from starvation during the Great Leap Forward of the early 1960s. In other words, it was the largest humanitarian disaster East Asia had seen for decades. Others say it was far, far worse than Lankov's estimate. The most highly placed defector from the regime believes the number of dead was 3 million. This dispute cannot be satisfactorily resolved until the regime falls. Big numbers dumb the mind. In Seoul, we met a defector, a man with a plastic hand. He gave me some sense of what that word famine meant. Ji Song-ho saw dead bodies piled up in the streets, near railway stations and in parks. Family and friends wilted under the hunger. Many died. I think I lost my mind from dizziness, sleep deprivation, and hunger. My grandmother and my neighbors died of starvation. It wasn't just where I lived. When you went into the cities, train stations, markets, and alleyways, you found lots of dead bodies. I do not know the exact number, but countless people died. Countless. He was so hungry he risked stealing coal from a train. One of the railwaymen pulled the wrong lever and the train was suddenly sidetracked towards policemen on a platform. G jumped and fell between the concrete of the platform and the train's wheels. When G came to, his hand and leg were hanging off. They amputated both without anesthetic. The moment G told me about corpses piling up near the railway stations, I knew he was telling the truth. People dying of starvation don't want to die on their own. They seek out a public place, perhaps in hope of some last-minute salvation. I'd heard that several times from Russian and Ukrainian survivors of Stalin's Great Famine in 1933. Some ironic souls even dared to die in front of statues to Stalin and Lenin. Malcolm Muggeridge wrote of Stalin's famine in 1933, one of the most monstrous crimes in history, so terrible that people in the future will scarcely be able to believe it ever happened. Back then in the Soviet Union, while George Bernard Shaw proclaimed there was no famine, people were eating each other. A 93-year-old Ukrainian lady remembered one of her neighbors being taken away after a child's arm was found in her stove. Cannibalism came to North Korea in the late 1990s. This famine, like Stalin's, is a monstrous crime people scarcely believe ever happened. What could be worse than fear of starving to death? Why didn't people rebel? The man with the plastic hand explained. In North Korea, if you say the wrong thing, you will die. you will be sent to a political prison camp. Even if one knows, sees, or hears something, one must pretend to be ignorant. Disagreement isn't an option. Disagreement means death. Fear of the regime is greater than fear of starving to death. That is a formidable tribute to the force of the tyranny. At no time throughout the famine did the secret police let up. One defector is quoted in Gosse's pamphlet on the Buibu and other state organs of control, reporting on the state's demand that each urban household had to produce 30 kilograms, 66 pounds, or more than 4 stone, of dried human excrement mixed with soil to help fertilize the countryside. It was a battle for people to produce 30 kilograms of compost per family in a severe winter. People frantically scratched the floor of their conventional toilets to collect the meagre excrement there, meagre because it is the discharge of people who are nearly starving. If you are suffering from famine, human excrement resembles rabbit droppings. All residential areas were filled with the smell of human excrement that was being dried. To make things worse, Dong, the district subdivisions of the Buibu secret police offices, had Inminban compete with one another by preparing charts of competition for securing excrement. International organizations are not good at working out what is happening behind the scenes inside dictatorships. While some Westerners were saying there was no problem, North Koreans were eating one another. The famine peaked in the late 1990s, but many were starving long before that. Kim Yong was a lieutenant colonel in the North Korean National Security Agency before he was arrested in 1993, when his father's work during the Korean War as a translator for the Americans emerged in a background check. In Long Road Home, he tells the story of a police investigation into the deaths of 13 people in Kim Il-sung's birthplace, close to Pyongyang. A doctor saw fresh meat on sale in the market at an unusually low price and with horror realized that he was looking at human flesh. The police investigated and discovered that 13 people had been killed by the butcher and his family and resold as meat. The former officer recalls 2 more stories of cannibalism, of an old man going to a cemetery, digging up the freshly buried and marinating the meat before eating it, of a grandmother driven mad by hunger, boiling her grandchild alive. These stories